You're listening to Taking Liberties. Taking Liberties is the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. We open with a panel discussion reviewing some progressive victories coming out of ballot initiatives in the 2018 midterm elections, as well as a discussion of some competing perspectives on Marcy's Law and victims' rights bills. Our guest for this episode is Robert Anderson, the director of the Native American Law Center and professor of law at the University of Washington. Professor Anderson discusses his recent article published in the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review titled Indigenous Rights to Water and Environmental Protection. We then close with a tribute to Karen Lewis, the president of the Chicago Teachers Union and a long-term labor leader. Let's get started.
Thanks for listening to Taking Liberties, the Harvard Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Law Review podcast. My name is Emily Morrow, and I'm here with two of my co-panelists. We've got to my left.
Hi, this is Joe Meeker.
And
I'm Graham Sternberg.
Great. Thanks, guys, for joining this panel today. We've got a couple of great topics that we're going to be talking about today. A few are related to some ballot initiatives, some measures that passed after the midterm elections earlier in November. And Joe, you'll be speaking about Marcy's Law?
Mm-hmm. There were quite a few states that passed Marcy's Law as part of a ballot initiative. So looking forward to talking about that.
Great.
And I'll be talking about an initiative in Washington, Initiative 940, that changed their standard for prosecuting police misconduct, and then Proposal 1 from Michigan, which legalized marijuana in the state.
Okay, great. And two of the initiatives that I wanted to talk about are also related to the criminal justice space, one of which is Amendment A in Colorado, which voted to officially abolish prison slavery or uncompensated labor within prisons. And then the other is from Louisiana, which is related to unanimous verdicts for felonies. So I guess we'll start with the Louisiana initiative, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this as well. So before this voter initiative, or before the law was changed in Louisiana and this ballot initiative came to be, Louisiana is one of only two states that allowed non-unanimous jury verdicts to render a conviction in non-capital felonies, and the other state is Oregon, which is interesting. So the legislature voted to change this, and then Amendment 2 was on the ballot, and voters had the opportunity to vote on this issue as well. I don't know if you guys knew much about the history of this law, but I didn't know much about it. But it's really a vestige from the Jim Crow era. It's a product of this convict leasing system, which developed in the late 1800s, 1880s, 1890s, in response to Reconstruction. And basically, the state had sort of set up this convict leasing system whereby individuals who are incarcerated could be leased out to plantations or other factories or other businesses, I guess. And the state, in order to submit more individuals to the convict leasing system, passed laws to make it easier for prosecutors to convict people, one of which was the non-unanimous jury verdict law. So, yeah, did you guys know about this history? I didn't know about it until I started reading about this.
No, I actually did not know that there were any states that had non-unanimous juries at any point. So I was very interested to learn about this.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's one of those laws when you're thinking about, like, the civil rights movement. There are so it's interesting that this one stayed on the books for so long compared to other similar laws that have racial disparities and implications for inequality. It's interesting. I wonder, like, why this one persisted. That's a question for another day, I guess. So in any case, the non-unanimous jury verdict law, this law that was on the ballot initiative, it obviously has implications for disparate racial impact. And of course, when you think about why we require unanimous juries, it's because so many voices are otherwise marginalized or silenced within the jury system. So, yeah, I mean, the other thing that maybe was surprising, or actually it wasn't that surprising, I guess, depending on how you think about it, but there was pretty strong bipartisan support for this ballot initiative. I mean, I think I just did a little bit of research and it seemed like initially the prosecutor's bar maybe took a vocal stance against it, but ultimately the DA has remained pretty neutral. I think that just speaks to how incredible it is that this law was still even in existence up until a couple weeks ago. And I think Oregon, the state legislature in Oregon, has put forth a bill to address this as well. So curious to see how that will play out.
Do you know whether Louisiana, because of this non-unanimous jury rule, had an especially high rate of convictions in jury trials or like higher than other states?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's an article that's actually on the CRCL amicus blog on this issue. It's called 10 Angry Men, How Voters Can Change Louisiana's Non-Unanimous Jury Law.
Obviously, there's a lot of inertia around changing any law, and especially something as longstanding as this, and on a procedural issue that at first glance does not seem that exciting. But I think You know, in popular culture, people understand that jury verdicts are supposed to be unanimous, that if we're going to trust this group of 12 people to be the conscience of the community and decide whether someone is going to receive criminal sanctions, I mean, I think the idea that it needs to be a majority has a lot of moral salience. So, yeah, I guess, you know, given the fact that it already existed, I'm surprised that it changed, especially since there are a lot of powerful stakeholders, including prosecutors, who have a vested interest in keeping the system the way it was. But to your point, it is very exciting that it was a bipartisan initiative and that it was able to pass by a pretty significant margin, as
mm-hmm.
I understand.
Mm-hmm. Joe, would you like to speak about your issue, and then we can maybe go around and circle back?
Sure,
yeah. So this was something that was brought to my attention, also from the CRCL Amicus blog. So go check that out if you haven't been reading it.
Good work over there.
Yeah, it's doing some very good work. So one of the things that a lot of people have heard about this, but there's this piece of model legislation out there called Marcy's Law, and it's a proposed constitutional amendment that a state can adopt that is essentially a victim's bill of rights. So it, in its purest form, it enshrines a number of victims' rights into a state's constitution. And I had heard about it before. I knew that a couple of states had instituted it, but I was not aware that there were so many ballot initiatives related to whether states should take up Marcy's Law. And so last week, voters in Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Nevada, North Carolina, and Oklahoma approved Marcy's Law as a ballot measure. And Marcy's Law is pretty controversial in civil rights and civil liberties circles for a couple of reasons. At first blush, a victim's bill of rights sounds very appealing, but even some victims' rights advocates have come out against Marcy's Law. One, because the language of the model legislation or amendment is very vague. So a couple of states, even states that have already passed it, have had to amend the amendment like a year later to make clear what the language means, or it's overly broad in terms of the rights that it gives victims or the ones that it takes away from defendants. The biggest issue is the fact that some of these victims' rights, especially the right to privacy, wind up butting up against the rights of the accused and the rights of defendants in these criminal cases. For example, there's a right to privacy, which, again, seems like a good idea for victims, that, you know, their privacy is being respected and that they're being hounded by prosecutors. But in practice, it can allow them to withhold evidence by refusing discovery or a deposition. And so it has led to situations where exculpatory evidence hasn't been brought out because the victim was able to withhold it. So there winds up being this tension between victims' rights, which is an admirable goal, and how in practice it winds up taking away defendants' rights and the rights of the accused. And it's especially problematic in a system where we assume that everybody is innocent until proven guilty. And the amendment in law seems to take the worldview that it's the victims versus the criminals. And it sort of misses the distinction that it isn't the victims versus the accused. It's the state versus the accused trying to incarcerate them or bring criminal sanctions. And so it creates this sort of adversarial dichotomy that isn't really analogous to what happens in litigation or in a trial. So the ACLU has written about why they aren't in favor of it, largely because of its vagueness and because of the way that it infringes on the rights of the accused. One of the more interesting things to read was the ACLU published a couple pieces from victims' rights advocates who say that it will have a negative effect on criminal defendants without actually targeting the sorts of problems that they see in terms of victims' rights. So one of the things that they highlighted was victims are often left out of the process entirely. And so there are steps that you can take to involve victims and make sure that they feel heard and that they have a stake in the proceedings that don't infringe on the rights of the accused. Similarly, one of the big things they highlighted was a lot of states already have laws like this on the books, but the state isn't funding those programs adequately. So a more effective solution than enshrining some of this in a state constitution would be, all right, we want victims to have a voice in this process, so let's make sure that we have resources for them to meet with prosecutors and law enforcement, that we can do things like arrange transportation to trials or to hearings or depositions if that's something they're interested in, making sure that any victims of any crime have access to resources like counseling and rehabilitation. So there's a number of steps that could be taken that are not as extreme as what Marcy's Law proposes, But clearly, a number of states looked at it and decided that it was something that they wanted as part of their criminal justice system.
So that would be like victim impact statements, sort of like pre-sentencing. Is that one of the alternatives that you've read about or heard about?
Oh, so that's one of the things about Marcy's Law is it actually allows for victim input at places other than sentencing,
okay.
I believe. So that is one of the other controversial things about it is that as it stands, a victim can give an impact statement at the sentencing stage, but before that, I'm not sure what sort of role that they would play in like trial proceedings, but mm-hmm. it is more limited now, and that's one of the things that Marcy's Law opens up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea is that there are solutions that can keep victims involved and have and make sure that they feel safe and heard and cared for throughout the process, because I do think in a lot of cases the victim is an afterthought. You have the defendant, you have the facts, and the inciting incident that led to the creation of Marcy's Law is the mother of the woman who was murdered and gives name to the law, Marcy. She saw her daughter's killer at the grocery store and had not been made aware of the fact that he had been released, I think it was on bail. And that is a problem. We mm-hmm. should be more communicative with victims, and we should be involving them in the process more, because very many of them were, in fact, victims of crimes. But what the ACLU takes issue with and what a lot of commentators have said is a problem with it is it achieves those goals to an extent, but then it also oversteps in trying to give rights to victims and winds up infringing on other rights. So, in fact, one of the things that the ACLU recommends is different, more specific model language that makes it clear that it doesn't conflict with any existing rights given to the accused or defendants in criminal trials. So that would be an improvement on the existing language.
Okay, great. Thanks, Joe.
So I'm here to talk about, well, the first thing I'm going to talk about is Initiative 940 from Washington. So this was an initiative trying to address Washington's legal standard for prosecuting police use of force cases. And the standard that they had prior to this initiative passing was that it was required that you show that the officer had malice in order to take any action against them. And that is exactly what it sounds like. You had to prove that there was some sort of evil lurking in the hearts of the police officers that had shot somebody. And what that did practically was made it just literally impossible to take any steps when there was some sort of use of excessive force. And so this initiative passed with 60% of the vote, which is pretty good. And it does a lot of things. It actually does a lot more than just change the standard for police misconduct. But it does do that. So it takes malice, the idea of malice, out of basically every part of the process, and it replaces it with a two-part test, which is called the good faith test. And so that test asks whether a reasonable officer, knowing what the officer in question did at the time, would have reached the same conclusion that it was necessary to use deadly force. And then it asks whether this officer actually did feel that way, which is a lot closer to the tests that are used in every other state. Now, the test still has its problems. So the amount of leeway that we're typically ready to give an officer in determining what is reasonable is extraordinarily broad. We find lots of circumstances where, you know, police officers are in fear for their lives for whatever reason and shoot somebody and that person dies. And we're ready to excuse it. But at least this sort of opens the possibility of further litigation and investigation in a way that was just completely foreclosed by the malice standard. I imagine many of our listeners are law students or lawyers, but if you're not, anytime you have to look for intent, you're just almost always sunk. It's a pretty pernicious hobby that we have in the legal field, is trying to discern the intent of someone, and it just usually goes badly. Unless we've decided they're a criminal, and then it's just the easiest thing to find. But we have not predetermined that the police are criminals, so the malice standard, very bad. But in addition to reducing the standard, it also mandates investigation whenever there's an act of serious police violence. So as part of the, like, investigation into the good faith standard, whether or not someone has brought a lawsuit, the state, an independent body, does need to investigate the actual facts of the shooting or, you know, whatever violent act there was. And that's statutorily mandated, which is, I think, pretty cool. And then it also mandates de-escalation and mental health training for police. The standards for those courses are developed with representatives from the police and representatives from impacted communities. And it gives a lot of suggestions about things that it's sort of deceptive phrasing. There are a lot of things that the police must think about including.
They must consider.
Yes.
Including?
Okay. Yeah. They, it's not that they must be included. They must consider whether they want to include them. And those include de-escalation, alternatives to jail, arrest, or citation when they encounter someone sort of out in the world, implicit and explicit bias training. The thing that I love, it would be amazing if this were just a required course for every police officer, is the historical intersection of race and policing, which, as Emily mentioned just a little while ago, is fraught. And then when scenario training on when to shoot, when not to shoot, alternatives to deadly force, all sorts of fun stuff that they have to maybe think about implementing. But all of that said, it does have one part that is most certainly not toothless and addresses just like a real standing problem. And that's that the statute requires law enforcement officers to render first aid. And as it's currently written, this is sort of a no ifs, ands, or buts thing. If someone is injured, the officers must try to save their lives, which addresses a lot of problems that we've seen, not so much in the last year, but 2 years ago and for a few years before that. There were lots of images of people who had been shot by the police who were just bleeding in the street, and the police were standing around watching it happen, waiting while the person died at their feet, which is very common. Even just this fall, my fiancé, who's a nurse, and I were walking through Boston Common, and we saw a guy who was very, very drunk, who fell and hit his head. And she, being a nurse and obligated to do so, rushed across the street to help him. And before she got there, the police, who are always around the common, kind of came over and just watched the man lying on the ground bleeding from the back of his head as she, like, put down our groceries and she started to help him. And I sort of stood haplessly by because I'm not a medical professional. I had nothing to offer. And so she was forced to take care of this guy until the paramedics arrived. But the police did nothing to help him. And they all said to her that they had no training. They did not know first aid. They had no first aid kits. And so shortly after that, after he was taken care of and the paramedics had taken him away, she went and spoke to one of their superior officers. And he said, there's a first aid kit in every car. Mm-hmm. And we train everyone. What were they talking about? But they have no obligation to help, at least not in that way. And so this does mandate that. However, this law is a little exciting. It's had some time in the court even before it was passed, in that the legislature, in an agreement with some of the supporters of the law, tried to amend the proposal prior to it being adopted on Election Day. And Washington courts said that they weren't allowed to do that. It had to be addressed by the electorate as written, and that they are welcome to amend it through legislation after it is adopted, but could not beforehand. And what they were trying to do was to weaken some of the language that governed police use of deadly force and, importantly, change the language on the mandate to provide first aid so that police didn't have to do so if they thought that doing so would put them in danger. There's a very strong chance that that might be redone now that the law has been passed. The legislature might go back and do those things that it could not do before, which would be a shame because it seems very easy to say, oh, I didn't provide first aid to this person because I thought I was in danger. Maybe they were thrashing. Maybe I was worried, oh, do they have a bloodborne disease? Like, there's a lot of wiggle room there to get out of providing life-saving care to someone that you've just shot.
Yeah, I mean, that actually reminds me of the fact that obviously the reasonable officer standard is much better than a malice standard, but a lot of these shootings are excused by the fact that the officers thought that they were in danger, that their safety was threatened. It was the only thing that they had to do. So I feel like, having seen how successful that defense has been in a context with potentially much more serious ramifications, I could similarly imagine that that would excuse a lot of inaction. If, you know, a subjective belief in danger was enough to keep you from providing that aid.
Right. And I should mention, I actually did not think to look into whether there's an obligation to provide first aid in Boston. That would be a fun thing to investigate. But certainly there was no sense of that obligation.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I'm really curious what this first aid standard is across different states. Mm. Like, do you know at all how the Washington bill compares?
I don't know how it compares. I do know that it's completely new language for Washington. Mm-hmm. But as we said, they had the worst, like the least restrictive laws in this area to begin with.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you, Graham, for that really thorough discussion of this issue. I learned a lot just now. So also in the criminal justice realm, another ballot initiative that I wanted to talk about was Amendment A in Colorado. So as we all know, the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution abolished slavery with an exception, and the Colorado Constitution has a similar exception. So I'll just read the language of the Colorado Constitution, which mirrors the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution. So currently, Section 26 of Colorado Constitution states, "There shall never be in this state either slavery or involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted." So what Amendment A does is remove all of the language after servitude. So Amendment A asks, "Shall there be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution that prohibits slavery and involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime, and thereby prohibit slavery and involuntary servitude in all circumstances?" And the citizens of Colorado, the good citizens, voted to pass this amendment. And it's interesting. In 2016, there was a similar amendment in the state constitution, which didn't pass. But most people think that it was because the language in that particular amendment was confusing and it wasn't clear, and people just didn't know what they were voting for.
Yeah, the language in that amendment is not only very clear, it's extremely striking.
Yeah.
Which I really like, because I feel like there are people who, even people who might theoretically be comfortable with no minimum wage for prisoners or them not being compensated for their labor, you know, in the abstract, they may think, well, I'm okay with that. But when it's just framed as, do you want there to be slavery or involuntary servitude in Colorado? You're going to say, of course not. So that's pretty cool. Whoever drafted that had the right idea.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's really interesting. Yeah, and I was looking up, I think there's at least 15 other states that have this as a provision within there that do allow unremunerated or uncompensated labor within prisons. I think it's really striking that this came up for a vote in the context of, or I guess in response to or around the same time, it's not in response to, but at the same time as the national prison strike just a couple of months ago. I think that that really pushed this issue to the forefront of sort of public, maybe not the forefront, but it really pushed this issue up as far as raising public consciousness around this issue. But yeah, it's shocking to me, again, that involuntary servitude or slavery, if you want to think of it in that way, is still permitted within prisons. I mean, we all know that the prison system is a big business and an exploitative one, and especially when you consider workers, laborers in prisons who'd be making less than a dollar or if that, sometimes nothing for the work that they're doing, and then face such barriers to employment after being released, it's pretty striking, I think. There's an interesting article also on the Amicus blog, which was published a couple weeks ago, called On the Ballot in 2018, Slavery, by our colleague Molly Coleman. And she lays out this issue, and she also talks about a couple of ways that we can be thinking about this issue or responding to it beyond state constitutional amendments in this way. So she talks about a lawsuit that's been brought by the Attorney General of Washington against GEO Group, which is one of the largest private prisons. And the lawsuit there is challenging the fact that they don't pay their prisoners or workers minimum wage, so failure to pay minimum wage in private prisons. And she highlights a couple issues with this lawsuit because, of course, it doesn't address state prisons. But another way that she talks about, she brings up another way that we can be thinking about this issue, which is unionization for workers within prisons. And maybe that's in tension with thinking about this kind of servitude as slavery, but it's just another way to conceive of or address this. Also, reform to the Prison Litigation Reform Act would be another avenue. Good on the voters of Colorado.
Yeah, you know, this summer I was at a fundraiser for the Rikers Debate Project, which is a project that helps prisoners in Rikers Island learn debating skills. They actually participate in debating competitions. It's a very cool program, but at the fundraiser, the question being asked was, should prisoners be paid minimum wage? And maybe this was just a function of the room I was in, which was probably more sympathetic to prisoners in general and maybe more progressive than the general population. But even the side that was assigned the task of advocate for why prisoners shouldn't receive the minimum wage had a pretty tough time coming up with really good arguments for it beyond just the fact that it's a punishment. And it does seem like public opinion, maybe just in general, is turning towards recognizing that, well, you can have a punishment of being incarcerated and being in prison, but that doesn't mean that your labor is less valuable. And if anything, if part of the reason is that you're supposed to be learning work skills, it makes a lot of sense to learn those work skills in the same sort of context and arrangement that you would, you know, develop them in the real world. The idea that you are actually getting paid for the work you do, I mean, obviously that's going to incentivize you to do a good job and stay on time. So, yeah, this summer was one of the first times that I really thought about it. But it's interesting that it seems to be moving pretty quickly towards recognizing that at least a minimum wage is a good idea.
Yeah, and I don't know all of the details, but I'm pretty sure that large corporations can contract with prisons to employ this work. So, of course, yeah. I don't know, Graham, what do you think?
I am very struck by the idea of unions in prisons.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't read that article from our colleague, and that I love it. I wonder, I have so many thoughts about it. One is, what are the chances that the warden of a prison would classify the union as some sort of gang and be able to get away with it because of the way that we perceive people who are in prison? And also, the success of the prison strike at kind of raising awareness really does point to the value of the union structure inside a prison, kind of regardless of the possible ramifications, of which there would be many because there always are inside a prison. That's just sort of the nature of things.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that it's not against the law to form a union within a prison. And it also speaks to the point that you made, Joe, about like seeing this work as providing additional layer of sort of humanity and dignity and... Yeah, I think it's a really interesting idea as well.
And I feel like there's an angle to be exploited over the idea. Maybe you can't convince somebody that a person in prison deserves the dignity of a minimum wage, which I disagree with. But having spoken to other human beings, I recognize that that is a stance that someone could hold. So much as the idea that a private organization doesn't deserve the benefit of someone's work without a reasonable wage, that they are obligated to pay that to someone. Because I feel like the perception is generally that people in prisons who are doing work are, like, I don't know, stamping out license plates or something. They're doing things for the state. They're helping the state apparatus function, which they should also be compensated for. But I could see how that sort of puts a gloss on it of, like, not being as necessary. There is no true beneficiary. They're just sort of ambiently doing work that needs to be done. Or something. But maybe if you address the idea that, like, a private company is receiving something for this, well, who are they to get this benefit?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the idea that even people outside of prisons should receive a dignified wage for providing benefit to corporations can be controversial depending on who you ask.
No, that's very fair.
I think that is a very good framing.
Great. Did anyone else have any other issues that they want to talk about on the panel today?
I've got one more. It is Proposal 1. Out of Michigan. It legalizes marijuana for recreational use in the state. It makes it the first Midwest state to do so, which is pretty exciting. It passed a little less resoundingly than Initiative 940, though not by much. 56-44 was the margin there. So it is just like your pretty bog standard marijuana legalization bill. Looks a lot like the one in Massachusetts. If our listeners are familiar with that, it does have one, like, fun little thing that you have to do. If you're going to grow marijuana or store marijuana, you need to hide it. You're allowed to have it, but it has to be secret. It can't be visible from a public place unless it could only be seen using binoculars or a helicopter, or I guess a plane. And it has to be kept inside a place with working locks. Presumably, this is all to keep people under 21 from getting their youthful little mitts on the marijuana. But I thought that was a fun little wrinkle. I think the more interesting and maybe civil rights oriented part of that is that Michigan had 23,500 arrests for marijuana in 2016, which disproportionately targeted black Michiganders at a rate 2.6 times higher than whites. There's nothing in the proposal to do anything to like grant clemency for anyone who has been arrested for marijuana. I don't know really what procedures are going to be undertaken in order to make that a reality. But just by the text of the proposal alone, you could be, you know, arrested for possession the day before it goes into effect and then would not have been the next day, which is a tragedy. The other thing that it does is it creates a sales tax of 10% on all marijuana revenues. And those are earmarked to go into a couple very specific funds. It goes to the state's public schools, the transportation funds, and the local communities. So I did a little look into the school aid fund in Michigan, which does most of the funding for their schools. And what I was trying to check was how the funds from the marijuana would be distributed. And so the school aid fund overall goes to every school in the state, except for those that have already raised enough funds from municipal property taxes that they're over a certain threshold. So its goal I'm by no means a tax expert, but seems to be to bring every school up to a certain threshold. And if you already exceed that threshold, you receive less funding from the school aid fund. But the marijuana tax revenues are earmarked to be distributed in proportion to where the revenues are generated, which is, I think, theoretically good. But if Massachusetts is any indication, it will be problematic because at least here, I think the abundance of people who have had permits to go into the recreational marijuana business have generally been in fairly well-to-do areas. And I think that has a big chance of sort of propagating this criminalization of people of color for marijuana while permitting white people to sort of enjoy the fruits of of the enterprise. And that it would, more than just making it difficult for people of color to engage in the business aspect of it, the benefits of the business for the community would also be predominantly directed to areas that don't need it. Assuming that past trends hold, it could be trouble. It's obviously not guaranteed to be the case, but it seems to be the mechanism that it's sort of set up to create. So I'll be interested to see where that goes.
Fascinating. This was a great panel discussion. Thanks for taking the time to chat today. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Taking Liberties, the podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Law Review.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Well, welcome to this week's interview for Taking Liberties, the official podcast of the Harvard Law Civil Rights Civil Liberties Law Review. My name is Joe, and I'm here with Professor Robert Anderson. Thanks for taking the time to speak, Professor.
Sure, it's great to be here.
Professor Anderson is a professor and director of the Native American Law Center at the University of Washington School of Law and is the Oneida Indian Nation Visiting Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. And importantly for us, he was published this fall in CRCL with an article on indigenous water and environmental rights. So I wanted to start by something that struck me from your article, which is that more than 350 treaties with Native American tribes do not mention water rights, which struck me as something of an oversight. But despite this, after a lot of litigation, courts have recognized some implied water rights that have been given to these tribes and reservations. So could you talk a little bit about the scope of those rights and how they're implied?
Sure. I think that your surprise at the treaties not being explicit can be understood by the fact that it's so obvious that if you're setting aside land for homeland purposes for a tribe of Native Americans in the arid West, that you have to have water. And so I think that obvious nature of the need was overlooked in drafting the treaties. It was taken as a given. And quite sensibly, the Supreme Court in the Winters versus United States case in 1908 naturally found that an Indian reservation that was created by an agreement to induce the tribe members to become farmers and have an agrarian economy also included enough water to fulfill that farming purpose, because you had to irrigate, otherwise the lands would be practically valueless, according to the Supreme Court. And so That early, implied right in the Winters case has consistently been followed by the lower courts and by the U.S. Supreme Court in the several cases that it's heard over the years, the last one being in 1988.
Mm-hmm. And with those rights having been recognized by the courts and having been a little bit more firmly established, your article goes into how the recognition of those water rights also implies certain environmental rights. So could you speak a little bit about how those are related?
Sure. There was another case involving an Indian treaty around the same time as Winters. This is the U.S. versus Winans case that was decided in 1905. The Yakima Nation in that treaty in 1855 had reserved a right to fish at its usual and accustomed fishing sites. And in order to exercise that right, they had to cross private property, and there was no mention of an easement to cross private property in the treaty. And the Supreme Court in this 1905 case said, well, it's implied. It's an implied easement, something we all learn about in our first year property course, and it's a burden on the private property just as if it were written in the deed to that property. And that case has engendered a sort of a parallel line of litigation and pretty much consistent tribal wins related to protection of habitat for fisheries, to water rights in in-stream flows, that is the right to keep water in the river, the right in the most recent U.S. Supreme Court case decided just this past year involved the right to preclude the state of Washington from blocking fish from moving up and downstream during various life stages. In other words, the state could not exercise its authority in such a way as to inhibit the ability of fish to survive because the tribe had a treaty right to take those fish mm-hmm. under its treaty.
Interesting. So from that, it sounds like you can just intuit a broader set of environmental rights to use the land and mm-hmm. be protected. As recent events would show us, though, those environmental rights are not always protected as vigorously as we would expect. You write a little bit about the litigation around the Dakota Access Pipeline and how existing doctrine and case law really didn't wind up playing much of a role in how the pipeline process was decided. Do you think that there are ways to improve communication across tribes and the federal government or actors like people trying to institute those pipelines, ways to improve the situation or recognize those rights?
Let me answer that in two different ways. First off, I think where the tribes have been successful in obtaining federal court protection for these implied rights to water and habitat, there's been a pretty direct impact from some other project on those treaty-based rights. And so in the Culver case, the judge saw pictures of fish that were stacked up dead along a stream where a culvert blocked passage underneath the highway. In the water rights cases, you have non-Indian irrigators taking the water out before it gets to the reservation. In a case like Dakota Access and other activities that take place off of tribal lands, it's more difficult sometimes to show the direct impact on a treaty right. So in Dakota Access, for example, the pipeline company craftily picked a route that was off the reservation and pretty much entirely on private or state land. So there was not much federal permitting involved at all. And when the Army Corps of Engineers needed to get involved to issue permits to go underneath the Missouri River a couple of miles from the reservation, it was difficult for the tribe to demonstrate that there was going to be a direct impact either on reservation land or on the water. There was certainly was a risk that was being taken into account under the National Environmental Policy Act process, and there could have been effects on the tribe's cultural and religious resources that were located off the reservation. But the rights under those two statutes are procedural in nature only, and so the tribe had a right to be consulted, but ultimately it was up to the agencies to decide whether to issue the permit or not. And so because the right is only to consultation, if that is done adequately with the appropriate procedural safeguards, that's all the agency has to do, and it can go ahead and allow the project to go forward. And so one of the ideas I put out in the paper is that when there's an endangered species, for example, that might be jeopardized by some project, and an agency thinks that the granting of a permit to a third party might injure a threatened or endangered species, the agency has the authority to deny the permit and is mandated to deny the permit under some circumstances. And my thought is that tribes should really have some sort of a right like that that allows them a greater substantive voice in the process. The agencies, they know how to consult. So they come out and they do the meetings, and unless they really mess it up by refusing to listen or to meet, courts are generally finding that they've met their consultation obligations. But if you had some sort of a substantive component that would allow courts to more carefully scrutinize the content of the consultation that took place and balance the tribe's concerns with some weight against the agency's decision-making power, I think that would be important. So what I'm really talking about is shifting some of the authority to permit these projects, like the Dakota Access Pipeline, away from the federal agency to the tribes. And this would be for projects that are located near Indian country, that are near reservations. So there would be some sort of a threshold that would have to be met in order to get to that point. And certainly this is not something that the agencies would like. They, like all governments, they like their power that they have, and they don't like to share it with others. But the United States has always taken the position, at least in word, that it has a sacred trust obligation to Indian nations as the Aboriginal occupants and owners of what's now the United States, and that the U.S. should work with the utmost good faith in dealing with the concerns and rights of tribal peoples. And this would be an example where Congress would probably have to do this, although an agency might have authority on its own. But most readily, it would be Congress that has the power to enforce and require more substantive consideration of tribal concerns and put it at a level where the agency might be limited when it has power, when it is taking actions that might affect tribal rights and property.
Right. So you headed off one of my next questions, which is whether this is something that would have to be recognized in positive law, and it does sound like Congress would have to act. If Congress drags its heels or isn't able to pass that sort of positive legislation, do you see there being other strategies that tribes could rely on going forward to litigate similar cases or to navigate them politically?
Well, I think that the agencies do have regulations that require this consultation to take place. And the first line of advancement would be for the tribes to get the agencies to beef up those requirements on their own. And that would take, some political will on the part of the Secretary of the Interior, for example, or the Assistant Secretary for the Army Corps of Engineers, who often have projects that affect Indian tribes. So that's the first type of administrative action. The second one would be for the courts to put more teeth into these consultation rights that are in these statutes, like NEPA and the Historic Preservation Act. And the agencies have also taken it upon themselves in the NEPA process to require consideration of environmental justice concerns. And the Dakota Access Pipeline litigation is still going on. And the judge actually found that the Army Corps failed in its environmental justice analysis when it put the pipeline in without full consideration of tribal interests. He ordered the agency to go back and do some additional consultation. That's happened, and I noticed just yesterday, November 27th, that all the tribes have renewed their lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers. They filed amended complaints based on this latest round of agency action. Now, oil is flowing through that pipeline, but again, this would be an opportunity. You know, it's in the district court in the District of Columbia, and the Judge Postberg will have a chance to put some teeth into the consultation after looking at the record of what has transpired over the last 8 months in the consultation. So the courts could add some teeth. In addition, the other weakness in the judicial avenues that I identified in my article was that the courts have simply required agencies to follow existing environmental laws and not to give any special consideration to the Indian Trust Doctrine when tribes are complaining or involved in the process because a particular activity is located near their reservation. So maybe a tribe can't show a direct interference with a treaty right, like a water right or a right to fish, but they've got concerns about groundwater contamination coming from a mine a dozen miles away that's leaching into the or acid into the ground. And in these cases, the courts have said, well, it looks like the agency complied with the National Environmental Policy Act and these other statutes, and there's no heightened obligation. And the Supreme Court has never said that. Unfortunately, the Ninth Circuit has said that in a couple of cases. They've left a little wiggle room, you know, most of the tribes with these big resource problems are located in the Ninth Circuit or in the Tenth Circuit. So it would be a real breakthrough if our Supreme Court would find that there was a heightened duty again on the part of the agency to take an additional step when permitting activities that have a nexus to tribal reservation lands, waters, air, health, cultural and religious resources. That hasn't happened. I'm not real optimistic about it happening, but that door has not been closed yet.
Right. So that sort of breakthrough, would that be an extension of the implied treaty rights to water and environmental protection, or would that be a new sort of recognition based off of the trust doctrine?
It would be a new recognition based on the trust doctrine when you don't have an explicit treaty right to water or to some sort of natural resources off the reservation that's involved in the case. Mm-hmm. So it does take it a step further. I cited a bunch of different articles by law professors over the years that have advocated for this, the courts have not been very receptive, but every lawsuit I see by a tribe involved in a case like the Dakota Access Pipeline includes those sorts of claims. You know, and it could happen that one of these situations will show the way for some judicial improvement of the law in that area, akin to the implied right to habitat protection that we see based on the treaties in the Pacific Northwest.
Great. Well, it will be interesting to see how that litigation shakes out. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Professor. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And thank you all for listening.
All right. Thank you.
For the Unsung Hero segment of this episode, I want to highlight and celebrate Karen Lewis, who is the former president of the Chicago Teachers Union. Karen Lewis recently stepped down from her position, and there are a number of reasons why I think it's important to celebrate her work and highlight her work now. This past year, the country witnessed a wave of teacher strikes among public school teachers, from a wildcat strike in West Virginia, moving on to Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, California, and elsewhere, still growing. And these strikes have popped up sometimes in unexpected places. And there are a lot of differences among them, of course, but there are a lot of commonalities. Essentially, these teachers are facing stagnating wages in geographies where the cost of living is steadily rising. And that's true of folks working all over. But essentially, these teachers are demanding fairer wages, better classroom conditions for themselves and for their students. For me and for, I think, a lot of people around the country, it's exciting to see this mobilization occur and see these demands being made. It's such an important expression of the right to collectively bargain, the right to associate, and especially when the Supreme Court seems willing to roll back some of these gains and roll back the power of the labor movement, especially after the Janus decision this past summer. Karen Lewis played an important role in the past decade of reinvigorating some of the energy in the contemporary labor movement, especially at a time when debates related to education reform were really contentious. Karen Lewis was elected to be the president of the Chicago Teachers Union in 2010, and 2 years later in 2012 led a historic week-long strike, which was notable for a number of reasons, but one of which was its strong support among parents in the public school system, and by the way in which larger sort of economic demands were folded into their strategy. And the strike was about many of the same issues, classroom conditions and salary, but it was also really about democracy and about putting teachers in a position to make decisions about their working conditions and their students' learning conditions and put them in a position to draw a vision for their communities. So the Chicago Teachers Union was really a pioneering force to put these kinds of movements back on the table for labor, whether in the education sector or retail or whatever else it might be. And there's a lot, I think, that these contemporary strikes can learn from history, whether it's the civil rights movement or other forms of collective action. And as we think about where social change is coming from or where it's going to come from, these expressions of the right to collective action start to feel really historic and momentous. So I want to celebrate that empowerment and celebrate Karen Lewis for her work with the Chicago Teachers Union.
You've been listening to Taking Liberties. Taking Liberties is the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights Civil Liberties Law Review. Our panelists were Emily Morrow, Joe Meeker, and Graham Sternberg. Today's interview was conducted by Joe Meeker. Today's tribute to Karen Lewis was recorded by Emily Morrow. Music for the podcast was written and performed by John Satta. The editors-in-chief of the Harvard Civil Rights Civil Liberties Law Review are Bree Frank, Amber Ashley James, and Ian Epler. The executive audio content editor is Mark Satta. Special thanks to our guest, Robert Anderson, and thanks to you for listening.